Hello there.
Tonight, I again proudly accept that nomination for President of the United States.
I have a bad feeling about this.
But when the President does it, that means that it is not illegal.
What?
Welcome to the Joy of Star Wars. I'm Simon, and with me, as always, are Vaughn and Steele. Hi, guys.
Hey, Simon.
Hello, Simon. You sound so riveted to be with us again.
I mean, I'm just delighted to be back, to be honest. Much like Emperor Palpatine, we have returned after a long absence. And we
somehow
we have returned.
Really feels good.
And this will be the one that will be critically mauled.
Maybe actually.
Yeah, I've been out of London for a while, and I'm finally back, and it feels like I have actually come back from the dead. So, here I am. I have returned somehow.
Here you are, our little Palpatine. Right. we will no doubt get caught up in conversations around Palpatine like we do on every episode, but we should probably try and move on to what we're actually going to talk today. And Vaughn, can you reveal our mysterious subject for today?
Yes. Today's conversation is about bodily autonomy. I have a very specific direction that I'm going with this for the episode. And I don't know if I should tell you what it is or make you guess.
So when we were talking before, the first thing that kind of sprung to mind for me, just like immediate off the top of my head, was, does that involve anything to do with the, you know, essential slavery of robots within the Star Wars universe? And it didn't, but it did kind of spring to mind what other aspects we could talk about. But I don't think that's going to be particularly covered in today's talk.
I'm not going to talk about that, but you can. Well, I am a little bit. There's a very little bit of that in what I'm going to present. But still, without looking at my notes, what are we talking about today?
I'm going to guess, judging from the evidence that's been given to me when you told me before we started recording, that you're going to talk about the clones. I assume you're going to talk about the clones. I mean, that was also, not to, you know, toot my own horn, but that was also what came to mind when you said we were talking about bodily autonomy, which is weird because you turned to me yesterday and you were like, what are we going to do the episode on? And I was like, well, Andor's coming out. And you were like, bodily autonomy. And
that was like, this morning, actually.
Oh, that was this morning.
That was this morning.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah.
But that's okay, because we have a whole episode on it and it's going to be good, I think. So, yes. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the clones and bodily autonomy. And Simon, that's an excellent point that you bring up about the essentially kind of slave labor of droids and robots within the Star Wars universe. And I do want to have more of a conversation about that later, after I go through all of this. So if you don't mind, do you want me to go ahead?
Yep. Just plant yourself fully in front of the microphone and off you go, Vaughn. Present that to us.
I will. So, bodily autonomy. As Steele just said, this came out of talking about Andor, or rather you said Andor and I yelled bodily autonomy. And within the Andor trailer that I'm guessing a lot of you have seen, but I hope this isn't a spoiler if you haven't, Stellan Skarsgård says the line, wouldn't you rather give it all to something real? Now, I'm not going to talk too much about Andor. I'm going to leave that to Steele, who I'm sure knows much more about the expectations of Andor than I do.
Probably not, but I'll give it a go.
All right. But let's jump in. So this episode was actually something that I wanted to talk about in June when we were on a bit of a break. So the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June of this year, 2022, with their decision on Dobbs v. Jackson, that the Constitution does not confer the right to an abortion. This decision left millions without a right to bodily autonomy, but many millions other already had reduced rights of bodily autonomy. And there's a question as to whether any of us truly have bodily autonomy at all. So let's start by defining bodily autonomy. What I mean by it here is that it's the right to choose what you do with your body and when. Now, that is a very wide definition, as it should be. It constitutes self-determination, self-governance, and self-performance as basic human rights. There are so many directions that we could take this in. We could discuss the bodily autonomy of self-presentation and performance being about gender and the ways in which you choose for yourself or are prohibited from choosing to represent yourself in society. This year in particular, but for generations, trans people in the US have had the option of being true to their own identities and expressing this outwardly, or hiding their true identities under threats of abuse, assault, and death. That is not a right to bodily autonomy. That is oppression. We could also take bodily autonomy to mean a right to choose your medical care. That is also an issue that is widely limited for the trans community, and it also encompasses many other groups, particularly marginalized and poor communities in the US. Within the US healthcare system, politicians regularly use the argument that we want quote unquote choice in our healthcare providers. They claim to believe that Americans don't want a universal healthcare option because that would mean they are devoid of choice. This belief about universal healthcare is incorrect, especially if we take the UK's National Health Service as a basis in which you can use the public option or have the freedom to pay for private healthcare outside of it. In the US, you are limited to the healthcare your employer chooses for you, or you can pay exorbitant fees for an external provider. You are then limited to doctors within your healthcare network, and you are further limited to treatments your healthcare insurance company deems worth paying for. You are also limited by pre-existing conditions. That is not bodily autonomy. That too is oppression. We could likewise take a look at the history of reproductive healthcare specifically and how inequitable that has been across American history. People of color have routinely in American history been used immorally and without informed consent for scientific experiments pertaining to reproductive and sexual healthcare. A famous instance is the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis between 1932 and 1972. In this study, the United States Public Health Service and Center for Disease Control and Prevention enlisted 600 impoverished African-American sharecroppers from Macon County, Alabama, and purposely infected 399 of them with syphilis, with the other 201 as a control group. The experiment was intended to observe the effects of syphilis when left untreated over a 40-year period, without ever informing the forced participants that they had the disease. Over 100 of the men died, and by the time the experiment was completed in 1972, the disease was entirely treatable due to scientific advancements. In 1997, President Bill Clinton finally issued an apology, but the damage of the study had already been done, and it was only one in a long history of medical abuse against Black communities in the US. We could talk about a plethora of instances and nuances in which Americans do not have bodily autonomy, but I want to talk about this one in particular today. It's not about reproductive health care, as I said, or other direct infringements against the human body, but one a little bit more philosophical than that. So, as I said, we're going to talk about the bodily autonomy of American soldiers. This past week, August 2022, President Biden issued a student loan debt bailout to aid nearly 45 million Americans impacted by crushing student debt. Student debt, by the way, can also be an argument under bodily autonomy because the largest question here is whether anyone under capitalism or really any governmental system has bodily autonomy fully and truly, or whether we are all kind of beholden to some degree by society and the obligation to perform within it. But that's a part of and also beside the point. So the student debt relief, also wipes the debt entirely from nearly 20 million Americans and reforms how student loans will be paid back in future. For the first time in my life, especially and personally, I can see a future in which I am not sorely struggling to climb out of my own student debt, but rather can have a life alongside it. We need more reform, but this is a really amazing start to those reforms. And one specifically excellent inclusion in this debt relief was the additional $10,000 allotted to recipients of the Pell Grant. The Pell Grant was designed to help low-income families afford the astronomical costs of higher education. Including the additional $10,000 allotment to students with a Pell Grant gave additional assistance to the poorest students, most of whom are from communities of color. Now, what this has to do with bodily autonomy and soldiers is that a sitting Republican representative said the quiet part out loud this week. Representative Jim Banks of Indiana tweeted, quote, "Student loan forgiveness undermines one of our military's greatest recruitment tools at a time of dangerously low enlistments," end quote. For decades, since higher education costs started to increase in the late 1970s and early 1980s, it has been speculated that the government abuses low-income communities as a military recruitment tactic, though the military and government formerly denied these claims. Historically, we can look at the benefits of serving in the U.S. military. In 1944, the Servicemen's Readjustment Act was signed into law, and that is better known as the GI Bill. The GI Bill was a set of privileges for predominantly white male veterans of World War II, with options to pay more into the privileges to receive greater benefits. These benefits included education, low mortgages, low interest loans for veterans, et cetera, but failed to account for Jim Crow era segregation and racism. Due to decreased options and resources available to Black communities in the US, Black veterans could not take advantage of the GI Bill as frequently or as robustly as white veterans could and did. Statistically, throughout American history, we see disadvantages along lines of racism and classism in the US military and its presumed benefits of service. We also, in the wars after World War II, see a shift in demographics of the military. This is due to a number of factors, including the widening of wealth disparity in the US, as well as the increase of costs of higher education and the implementation of conscription or the draft during Vietnam. Now, the draft was also instituted in the Korean War, World War II, and many of the wars before it. But the shift in demographics lies in these other cultural changes. Under conscription, college students are exempt. And in the early years of the Vietnam War, Kennedy had specific preference for husbands with children to be at the very bottom of the draft list, and husbands without children to be just above them. In the Vietnam War era, with increasing costs of tuition and greater educational opportunities across the board for white men, the men most likely to dodge the draft were wealthier white men. Additionally, the unwritten policy on conscription since the Korean War, according to Selective Service Director Lewis B. Hershey, was that for every man conscripted, three or four others would be scared into enlisting because those who enlisted got preferential placement over which branch and program they wanted to join. The US government used the threat of being drafted as a recruitment strategy. And those whom it would threaten the most were single men who could not afford the escape of higher education or who were discriminated against entering a university at all. Other ways to dodge the draft were by pressuring or bribing doctors or draft board members to forge a reason for why a person cannot serve. For example, bone spurs, like one well-known wealthy former president's draft card read. There have always been ways for the wealthy to avoid military service or at least frontline infantry positions in the war. Coming forward a bit to the most recent 21st century wars, One of the most common things you will find in American public schools is a U.S. military recruitment table in the cafeteria for at least a couple weeks out of the year. Troops in uniform prey on high school students who could not afford private school. The reason for this is George W. Bush's unbelievably unpopular No Child Left Behind Act, which was signed in 2002. No Child Left Behind includes a particularly sinister line that reads, quote, "The same access to secondary school students as is provided generally to post-secondary educational institutions or to prospective employers must be made available to military recruiters as well." The reason for military recruiters having access to children in secondary schools is to convince them that the military is a better investment than the exorbitant rates of higher education. And for many, it literally is, because we stopped funding higher education in the late 70s and Reagan gutted it even further in his administration. The US military targets poorer students from their mid-teens to recruit them for military service with benefits they know they can't afford elsewhere. There's the promises of job opportunity within the military during economic recessions, which was especially appealing in the late 2000s and early 2010s, with so many young people's parents having been laid off in the recession of 2008. There's the relief of paying for college if they make it through the service. And for some, there's fast-tracked citizenship. In 2014, the US military opened its service to undocumented immigrants who qualified under DACA, or Deferred Action for Child Arrivals, with specific language sets. For those who will say that the US military does not target poor people, the demographics in 2016, according to the Council on Foreign Relations, indicated that over 60% of military enlistments allegedly came from the middle class, being neighborhoods with a median household income between $38,345 and $80,912. But if we actually look at the MIT living wage calculator for 2016 data, the living wage for a household in 2016 was $65,680. If the poverty line and therefore class dimensions actually rose in accordance with rising costs, the military was not recruiting from the middle class and was in fact recruiting from mostly those just making the average cost of living in the US. So here's my question. Do military service members have bodily autonomy if they're preyed upon to enter the service or conscripted? Do soldiers who have a choice between extreme predatory debt for the rest of their lives for an education and joining the military with the risk of death actually have bodily autonomy? And further, if the government tells propagandistic lies about why the war the troops are fighting is being fought at all, if they scare the troops into volunteering with a threat of conscription, can we actually say there was informed consent when the troops signed up to risk their lives? In every war the US has fought since World War II, there's been ardent anti-war protesting and strong countercultural movements. The wars are so regularly and frequently for profit, for control of oil, to stifle communism according to American political ideological doctrine, to instill a democracy in countries that do not want it, to increase mythical American patriotism, to advance American interests abroad, and assert American dominance in the world. I personally don't believe that that is bodily autonomy. I personally believe that that is exploitation of the lowest classes, the stripping of bodily autonomy, and the use of poor people as a revolving door of troops. And I think Representative Jim Banks confirmed it this week with his tweet. Now for Star Wars. I think you can see where I'm going here, but I want to briefly highlight how amazing the conversations between clone troopers is throughout Clone Wars. The clone troopers throughout Clone Wars have an incredible philosophical journey of being humanized by Anakin and Obi-Wan especially. In the season 4 arc on Umbara, we get several scenes of clones questioning their own meanings of life and whether they were just born to follow orders and be cannon fodder, or whether their existence means their humanity. This is juxtaposed to the Separatist droids, who express some humanoid emotional and thinking capacities, but are used and abused regularly by the Separatists, as they are replaceable. General Krell's treatment of the clones on Umbara is detestable and meant as a wake-up call for viewers that some generals do see their troops as disposable and easily replaced. And I think it's a very compelling arc for the question of whether clones or troops have bodily autonomy or not. It's a very complex philosophical question that can get into many caveats and nuances, but I say that I want to believe clones and troops have bodily autonomy. I really want to. But when the generals in charge and the government in charge are disrespecting the troops in any way, lying to them, using them, fighting an unjust war, I do not believe they do have bodily autonomy. This conversation could also easily verge into the very poor treatment of veterans in the US and also in Star Wars, as seen most recently in Kenobi. But I think I will stop there and ask you guys, what do you think of this theory on bodily autonomy?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating one. And I guess I'd never really, prior to this conversation, never really connected the two consciously with regards bodily autonomy and, say, army recruitment or enlistment. I completely agree that if you're under the threat of, you know, extreme debt or violence or fear or something like that, you're absolutely, you don't have autonomy. Extreme examples in something like the stormtroopers that we see in episode 7, where it turns out, you know, they're essentially orphans that were stolen and conscripted without choice, so they would absolutely not be, that's essentially slavery. I think I have a hard time just in general with recruitment of soldiers and how that works with regards to the predatory nature of a lot of that kind of thing. And for instance, in the UK, I think UK is the only country in Europe which allows 16-year-olds to sign up for the army. So they don't even have to be adults in order to do it. I think they might not hit certain level of training or something until they hit 18, or they can't be officers or something like that, but they can sign up to be in the army at 16, and yet they're still essentially children. So, I have a real difficulty around young people. I mean, I only have to think of myself about my own ideas of the world and how the brain is still developing and how difficult it is for people to make informed decisions. And something as complex as war, that is very difficult indeed. So I'm not sure I have a detailed answer specifically on Star Wars beyond, like I say, I struggle with that concept just in general around a lot of people signing up for or not realizing what they're signing up for. And you only have to look at the history of something like Vietnam, where, you know, people were kind of initially sold on one thing and came back and experienced the war and were, you know, vehemently against the war. I don't know if there's anything in there, Vaughn, you want to comment on before you go to Steel.
I did not know that the UK allows 16-year-olds to enlist. That's wild to me. But in the States, we also do have like junior ROTC, JROTC, where you can be like involved in the military, but you're not actually enlisted, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But you're kind of like, it's like a promise ring to the US military. I personally find that abhorrent. I don't think any teenager should be making that decision. But at the same time, I do respect an 18-year-old's vote, absolutely. So it's a complex question, as you say. Like, I am quite pacifist. I don't think we should be fighting wars, especially not the, I don't know if you got that from my whole little tie right there, but I don't think that we should be fighting the wars that the US is enlisted in, apart from maybe Ukraine. But many of the wars that the US is involved in are quite frequently for profit. And I just don't find that a moral argument for sending 18-year-olds to die. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm with you. I think that teenagers can be informed and can be well integrated members of society for sure, but I do not think that we should be sending them to die before they've even had a chance, well, at all, but especially before they've had a chance to kind of pursue a life and education and all of the things that they want to do. I think it's a predatory thing to enlist a teenager into the military. That's a huge undertaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is always the case that, you know, wars have been fought with sort of older people sending younger people to die. And I think it's the human cost, both of the specific people that you're sending over there and obviously the extension, therefore, their families. But I think just as a society overall, the fact that you are open to this idea, I was just looking at here, you can actually start your application to join the UK Army when you're 15 years and 9 months. So you don't even have to be 16. You do have to get parental consent if you are under 18 to join. But the fact that you can start an application at 15 and 9 months, I think to me, that's just too young. I think it's one thing giving a 16-year-old the right to vote, because if they make a mistake, the worst thing they've done is voted for someone in a, you know, parliamentary procedure or whatever it is. Whereas, you know, if they sign up at 16, I think they have to stay there till they're 22, from what I've read. And, you know, they very much well could be placing themselves in harm's way, and they could be going down a path which they just don't fully understand yet. So it's difficult. I mean, I you know, I've had family members who fought in wars. You know, my grandfather was at Dunkirk and that kind of stuff. But to me, that's very different. You know, that's sort of essentially amateur soldiers joining savior attempt against the worst of humanity, rather than sort of professional choices being made for young people when they're 16 or 17. So it's a difficult one, and I don't mean to sort of belittle anyone who does join the army and, you know, who wants to make a career out of it. You know, if that's their decision, but it's complex when you think of the industrial nature of war and how much we spend on these things. And when you understand it a bit more, and as you get a bit older and you realize that we have wars so that we can keep having wars, and you begin to understand that, you know, a lot of the time we don't fight wars the way we do with something like World War II, where we're trying to stop an injustice from directly coming onto our shores. You know, there will be action taken by people in governments and by high up in the military so that we can, you know, invade someone, take their oil, or we can position ourselves to elect someone who will be more willing to speak to us across a table or things like that. And I think the concept of bodily autonomy, I think we just overall, I think we have to be more willing to understand what we're asking soldiers to do, and especially young people to do. It's something I struggle with, and I find difficult to fully wrap my views around.
I agree with you. It's a really difficult topic to talk about, and there are many, many factors and ramifications of those factors. I also want to say, like, I'm not trying to disrespect the troops. I personally believe that it is a respectful position of troops that I don't want them to be used by the US government for unjust wars. I'm now at an age where some of my friends who from high school who went into the military, or other people that I knew at the time that went into the military, have come back from service and are not happy with their decisions that they made in joining the military, that they don't like how the U.S. domestically has welcomed them back, that there's a lot of disrespect in the veteran affairs and how they are treated afterwards, and also in how they were used in wars, that they did things they're not happy with. And you read that kind of stuff all the time, that there are a lot of people who, if given the choice again, wouldn't re-enlist in the military or tell their kids not to. And that's not to disrespect, as you say, the choices that people make. If you are happy that you joined the US military and you're proud of your service, I'm proud for you. I'm happy you made a decision that was well-informed and one that you wanted to make. But I do think that in a lot of cases, it's an uninformed commitment that these very young people are making that frames the rest of their mental and physical and emotional and professional lives. So I think there are two kinds of things that we can talk about. One would be informed consent of joining the military, and one is very uninformed consent. And that's the one that I think is really lacking the bodily autonomy for the military.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, someone who's never been in the army, but has, I say, sort of historically had family there, I do fully appreciate the sacrifice that people make. And you know, when I look at the news in America and I see how badly soldiers and ex-soldiers are treated, and it's heartbreaking to think that people serve their country and, you know, get injured or just, you know, come back after a number of years and they can, you know, barely get a job or they've got not got health insurance, or in the case of someone, if they come from like Puerto Rico, they can sign up for the military and yet not have US citizenship. And it's just like, the very least you can do is grant citizenship to, I mean, Puerto Rico should have citizenship anyway, but that's a separate issue. But if you're, you know, willing to sign up to the army, then you should be granted citizenship, as far as I'm concerned, and all the rights that come along with that. So I'm completely with you in this idea of wanting to protect anyone who signs up from the military, you know, protect them from the people above them, and making sure that they don't go into unjust wars or they don't go into conditions that are harmful. And you want to also only have to look at the high percentage, or relatively high percentage, any percentage of these things, but off like the abuse that the women get, and you know, stories of rape or mistreatment there, and the silence that goes on within military system. It really does enforce about how vulnerable people can be, and how institutions can build walls of silence around those people who are in vulnerable positions. So I think, as you say, Vaughn, we without, you know, taking this all too seriously, but you know, it is a serious subject, we have to make sure that we respect people's decisions, but we also have to make sure that we respect people enough to question, are they being told the right things? Are they fully aware of what's going to happen to them? You know, is the US Army going to fund the original Top Gun and then have recruitment stations outside the cinema? You know, those types of things where you have to try and understand the bigger picture of what's going on as far as recruitment is concerned.
I also thought of Top Gun as well when Vaughn was talking. I was thinking about that movie, and my dad was telling me a story after we went to see the new one, which isn't as much of a recruitment video as the previous one, but
it fucking rocks.
Pretty good film. Yeah. But my dad said that he was talking to people from the Navy, and they were like, "It's fucking Top Gun. That's why I'm here. I had to deal with this shit because of fucking Top Gun." And personally, it's the idea of the draft and military recruitment is terrifying. Like the idea of the ways, like the ways it's done and the way they try and prey on the people that are most vulnerable to things. When Vaughn mentioned the offering of citizenship, I was just like, isn't that Starship Troopers? Mm. Isn't that what happens in Starship Troopers? And that's really scary. Especially, I was just thinking, because I completely forgot that in this country you can sign up at 16. And I remembered that my my granddad did that in World War II, and I think the youngest person to die in World War I was 14. And just the ways that people were coerced into joining the army back then, and even now, like now it's the same. It's really scary.
Yeah, I had a question for you, Vaughn, just around this, because you guys know Star Wars, as we keep saying, a lot better than I do. So when you initially mentioned this subject, like I say, my mind immediately went to and essentially the sort of enslavement of children for stormtroopers that then turn them into soldiers and they don't have a choice. What's the other sort of military representation in a slightly wider level on Star Wars with regards to this? You know, how much do we see be that the army or be that something like the Jedi, which we've talked about before, which is essentially indoctrinating children into a particular path at a young age. What's that representation like throughout the sort of Star Wars media, and is there kind of much meat on the bone as far as what's actually represented there?
I think the difference each army in the different trilogies and the different wars in Star Wars, they have different kinds of soldiers. The clones being bred from birth and having no choice in the matter, like that's why they exist. That's what they're for. I'd say them and the First Order's child soldiers, where they're stolen as children and raised to fight. They're the ones that have the least bodily autonomy because they are straight up taken, or in the clone's case, created for it and given no choice. Stormtroopers in the Imperial era, in the original trilogy, they are like volunteers. So they sign up for it. And I really like how they've done that in represented that in certain ways, like in Solo, where Han uses it as an opportunity to get out, because it's there, and they have the little recruitment video with the Imperial March theme written in major, which is genius. I love that. The rebellion, both times actually, the rebellion and the resistance are—they're obviously the small guerrilla force made up of individuals. And there's a lot of different kinds. As far as connecting it to reality, there's you know, strong allegory, but I think outside of episodes of the Clone Wars, like the Umbara arc, where it shows like the real, like it shows the darkness of war and generals that don't care about their men and will just send them to die. It really is quite varied. It can go from very surface level to very deep compared on who's writing it, I suppose. Another interesting one I quite like is the just a small one, but on Naboo, they only have their little security volunteer force, which that's another very different aspect from what seemed to be quite a fair and peaceful society.
Yeah, the only things I would add to that are in the Bad Batch, we also see like how the clone troopers are replaced for the original stormtroopers that we then see in episode 4. And you can see that they're like ardent volunteers who really think that the Empire is the best thing. And there's like a stark difference between what we have just seen through all of Clone Wars and the clones, and then these like volunteers for the Empire's army. And also the Mandalorians, who have their kind of guerrilla unit of the Death Watch, but that is much more along lines of a terrorist cultish organization that I don't think necessarily has an appropriate allegory for the US military in the way that I'm talking about it. That's a very different thing. You also get the rebel cell with Saw Gerrera and Steela and Lux Bonteri. And they again are like ardent rebels. So I think that kind of covers most of the fighting units that we do see in Star Wars media. And I think the clones are the best analogy for what I'm talking about with uninformed US military recruits, especially from poorer communities and of younger people.
I was just, when you mentioned the Bad Batch, I was just reminded of when they go back to Coruscant and the troops are all sitting in the mess hall. And throughout the Clone Wars, you see clone troopers represented by their different haircuts or little features that they have, like little tattoos or something like that, little marks on their armor where they've painted themselves, and how much that gets taken away during the Bad Batch, and how the troopers become more less individual and more as a mass group. And I think that's a huge thing when it comes to the loss of autonomy, is when you start seeing yourself as, and people start seeing you as, just part of a group. And losses are, and if you think about losses, it's a number and not individuals. I think that's a huge thing that's really well represented in Bad Batch.
Mm-hmm. It's a great point.
So one question I had for you both was just thinking about recent Star Wars media, and how that there seems to be some representation on both sides to do with, or yeah, representation of both sides with regards to maybe the tactics that have been used, and this idea of it's maybe not quite, I mean, it still is good versus evil. And we kind of talked about Disney's need to represent that. But the fact that there are, you know, questioning that the tactics of Saw Gerrera, you know, and torturing people, and the fact that, you know, we were showing the you know recruitment of orphans in episode 7 in order to make them stormtroopers and that kind of stuff. Do you think we'll continue to see a questioning of both sides and this idea of the industrialization of war, like we did in episode 8 when we visited the casino, and we see and understand that actually the people who are benefiting from this war are the warmongers, and they're selling arms on both sides. Do you think that that's going to be a continued theme, that Star Wars is very much going to reflect upon what it means to be in a galaxy of continuous war, and the tactics that are used from both sides?
I have my doubts because of the reception of The Last Jedi, and the amount that Disney course corrected when they did episode 9, I feel like just them just trying to make some kind of point about that. They probably will get scared of doing that again, at least in the mainstream, I think. The not necessarily showing the horrors of war or anything like that, but the gray areas of both sides, but that very particular thing of people profiteering, I feel like outside of, say, the Filoni, like, animated stuff, whatever's coming with next with that, or books and other media like that, maybe comics, I feel like those sort of things won't be done. I mean, I hope they are, because it's very interesting. It's very interesting stuff to talk about, but I worry that the Last Jedi made people think that Star Wars shouldn't be political, and that really annoyed me. So in the last one, they just made it not at all and just kind of did the usual evil boy versus the goodies, and it's quite disappointing. But I really hope they do, because it's a really good thing to talk about. And I think that was the brilliance of Clone Wars and its just natural target audience, and the way that it addressed that audience being kids with heavy topics that it could smarten them and wisen them up to things happening in the real world, which is a really good thing about allegory.
Yeah. I do hear you, but I think that at least in Andor, we are going to get some of it, because in the trailer, again, if you haven't seen it, I'm sorry. In the trailer, they introduce Saw Gerrera and also Mon Mothma. And in Clone Wars, we see them, I believe it's Clone Wars, we see them butting heads. Or maybe it's Rebels.
Oh, yeah, it's Rebels.
It's Rebels. In Rebels, we see them butting heads, that there's a way the Senate is doing this to undermine the Empire, and there's a way that Saw Gerrera is doing it. And they're two very different ways. So I think we will get a lot more, at least in Andor, I think we will get at least some conversation about that and some opposition about the ways to fight wars. There will be, I mean, with Saw Gerrera, there always is condemnation of those tiptoeing around and not doing enough and not being aggressive enough and waiting around to profit off of war. And then from the Senate side, we see opposition against those who are extremists and do go too far. So I do think that we'll get at least some conversation about that in Andor.
Yeah, I think that those particular things of the different ways to fight and people, I think we will see people profiting from like the Empire side of thing as well, because it seems like there's going to be a lot of look into like the Imperial hierarchy as far as the officers, which I'm really looking forward to. And I think from that side of it, we're definitely going to see more of that. And I'm really excited to see more Saw Gerrera, because he's a character that was quite underutilized in Rogue One, because that movie was a bit of a mess when it was being made. It was in development hell for a little bit. And I really liked everything they've done to flesh out his character. I'd love to see more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly the kind of thing that hopefully Disney won't be too scared to show. I do wonder with Star Wars, the fact that we keep returning back to the same or sort of stories off stories, as it were, with something like Andor, and whether or not that means that we are going to have to come up with new angles to look at things, as well as just sort of have the stories shoot off from the original, whether or not we are going to have to re-examine the original films or whatever it is in order to to sort of satisfy Disney's needs to continue to make Star Wars content for Disney Plus. I think what will be interesting is once Disney does start to move away from this sort of core story, and I think that's been talked about with Taika Waititi, isn't it? But him wanting to sort of transition in a way to tell his story, which is completely unrelated or mostly unrelated. I wonder what room they'll give him and others to examine things, or whether or not that will be of less interest because they'll have their own stories to tell and maybe they won't have the immediate time to sort of pick away at the sort of war theories quite as much. I obviously have no idea what it's going to end up being, but I'm interested to see how they're going to, if they do end up going sort of the two paths of one of, you know, the sort of Skywalker saga and the other is less connected to that, what that means for both stories as far as the content.
I think the further away they get from the Skywalker saga, the better when it comes to creating Star Wars media that's more, when I say more mainstream, I mean movies and TV shows, not thinking about books where they've gone hundreds of years after Luke, where it's his great nephew that loves death sticks and things like that, which is a real thing. But I think the further they go from that, just give us more from other aspects of the mythology, like give us Jedi from an earlier time. Let's see them in their prime. Let's see if it was still as backward or things were different. Lots of things like that. I mean, you can take any, I think that's what I'm looking forward to about Andor, is you can take none of the main characters from any of the original movies. Like most of the returning characters are side characters, like Mon Mothma and Saw Gerrera, and give it a place in the story, which is during the dark times, before Luke was a part of everything, before anyone was a part of everything that we really know and love from the originals, and show us what it was like for the little guy, just the individual. And I think that's really great. I want more stories like this. I really hope that it utilizes the possibilities that it has and doesn't just try and tie in with everything else and have someone show up at the end and be like, yay, you know, I'd love something serious. It looks like it's going for something like that from what I've seen. I feel like a lot of the effort for spectacle has been put into things like cinematography, judging from space shots that I've seen, as opposed to getting as many characters that we love in there, you know, which I think is a really solid choice. I hope that's how it goes, because I think Rogue One went into a really interesting idea with the rebellion, and how, because the rebellion are the heroes in the originals, and in Rogue One, they like Cassian murders someone because he can't have them be caught, so he just murders them without a thought because he feels like he has to. And the Alliance bomb Mads Mikkelsen, I can't remember his name all of a sudden. Urso, Galen Urso, there we go. Bombs Galen Urso. And they've done some shady things, and Cassian Andor justifies it by saying that he's been in the fight since he was 6 years old. This is what his life is, and this is what he's willing to do to fight the Empire. And I really like that. I really like the rebels being a gray area immorally, because it was something new, and I really hope we get more of that in Andor, because it should really shake things up.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, we're coming up to the hour mark now. Is there anything else we want to get in on for this subject before we move on to our quiz?
I was just I was just thinking about when we were talking about Kenobi earlier, I was reminded of a really good line that they put in there, which I'm really surprised they did it, actually, because I didn't think it would be put in because it wasn't like a priority of the story at hand. But when they have when Obi-Wan and Leia have a bit of downtime, Obi-Wan mm-hmm. mentions that he has no idea what his family looked like. He's just got little memories, little single like images. And I think it's a really tragic thing. The idea that he had no real choice in the matter, the choice was made for him. And because of that, there's an entire family that he has that he doesn't know about. He even says, I think I had a brother, which I think is just a wonderful line, because it's just, he might still be out there, you know, and he'll never really know because the choice was made for him to join mm-hmm. the Jedi instead. And there's some, what I really like about that is the Jedi don't take you away. They don't take you as a child. They get your parents to give you away. So there is that element of coercion there. And it just made me think of you needing parental permission to join the army if you're under 18.
Mm. Yep.
And the idea that they're promised a different life, a better life, and what that's meant for Obi-Wan in that series is that he's lost everything, and he's only got the only life he knows has been a life where he's had to fight and kill and see his best friend be burnt alive by him, actually. Yeah. So yeah, it's a very interesting point. I'm really glad they put it in the show. Little moments like that. I really hope they do more with that aspect of the Jedi being basically the same as the First Order in a lot of ways, except with less theft and more coercion. It's very interesting. And I really do hope they do more, because they touched upon it in Clone Wars as well. But yeah, there's always room for more with that.
So for fear of setting off another hour conversation, I don't think we've, because of our summer break, I don't think we've talked on air, at least since the majority of Kenobi's been out, I think, from what I recall. So just overall, can you kind of give your quick sort of summation of Kenobi? Because I remember we were talking about it and you guys were excited, obviously, and Vaughn was shouting at me for even asking the question. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed Kenobi. I thought it was a good show, and it was enjoyable. I think some people, not that we care what people online think, but there was some negative reaction to it, and some people felt that maybe wasted the show or wasted the character. It's not personally how I felt, but there was some of that in the reaction. I was just wondering, sort of relatively briefly, what you guys thought of the show and what you felt, how you kind of felt with the story that they told and the decision they made to tell that particular story.
I can't believe you just said Kobe.
No, Kobe.
Kobe. I really liked Kobe. And spoilers if you haven't seen it. I really, really was not expecting a Leia storyline, but I desperately loved it. I've also seen a lot online about people not liking the young actress who played Leia and saying that she was too annoying or too childish to play Leia. And to them, I say, get wrecked, because Carrie Fisher would have fucking loved that child. Like, she was in every way what I would imagine Leia would be as a 9-year-old. Like, I thought that young actress did an exceptional job portraying a character that we love so much and have loved in so many different iterations of her on screen at different ages, in different roles, in animated series as well, across books and comics. It is a perfect continuation of Leia in my view. So I don't understand that criticism at all. But yeah, I really loved it. I loved seeing Hayden back on screen, and obviously Ewan. I loved that in one episode, Hayden was Anakin in two different ages, and then also like Darth Vader. I thought that was wonderful to get three different views of Anakin slash Vader in one episode. Yeah, it really did so much for me. I really, really loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
So,
yourself still?
So Kenobi was weird for me because I enjoyed it the first time around. I really liked it the second time around because I knew what was coming. That happened to me as well with Boba Fett, I think. Especially with Kenobi, I really enjoyed it the second time around. The first time around, I liked it. I really liked the first two episodes. And then I thought the third episode was good, but I found a lot of the stuff with Vader, the way it was edited, kind of strange. But then upon rewatch, I liked it. I think it's just because I knew it was coming, and I think my own expectations got in the way, which is always a problem when you're a super fan of something. I think by the finale was incredible, and mm-hmm. that last battle with Vader was some of the best Star Wars.
So good.
Oh boy, yeah. Connecting it to Ahsoka's last fight with Vader as well.
Yes. Of the Apprentice at the end of Rebels season two.
Thank you. Vader gets his helmet cut open. And they did that again, but this time with Hayden Christensen there, and that was ridiculous. Like, I couldn't believe that happened. When I was watching it, I remember being like, they're going to do that, aren't they? Of course they are. They're going to do that. And then it happened and I was like, oh boy. And that little bit of dialogue they had together,
oh,
it was perfect. It was just not too much, not too little, nothing too cheesy, nothing too melodramatic. It was the perfect amount. It was just enough for it to still feel like Vader saying these things. It was wonderful. And, absolute killer performance from Ewan in that moment. He had to with the camera just like right up at his face, and him having to just really go for it while also holding back, while also like, because he's a Jedi, the idea that feeling emotions, like emotions is something you have to control, and him just letting loose. Oh, it was wonderful. It was really wonderful. Also the fight where Vader fought the third sister was brilliant. Just her swinging at him and him just sort of stepping out the way and him not even getting his own lightsaber out. And then at one point taking her lightsaber, snapping it in half, and then giving her half of it back. Oh, that was brilliant. That was prime Vader. I really like how, say what you will about Disney Star Wars in general, but the way they've handled Vader so far has been really, really well done in Rogue One, and even in Rebels, which is the show aimed at kids, the thing aimed at kids the most. And in this, like, there is that powerhouse monster, like this absolute boogeyman of a character that just everyone is terrified of. And there is such like stress when he's on screen. It works really, really well. And I'm so glad they managed to abstain from overusing him.
Yeah.
So two very, very quick questions before we finish up on this. One is, have you watched episode 4 since you've seen Kenobi? And if so, has that impacted any viewing on that yet?
I actually haven't yet. That's actually a good point. I mean, in one way, it's going to add an extra layer to Vader being like, oh, I sense a presence that I haven't felt since, because now there's another time that they met before this happened. but that doesn't, it doesn't really affect anything, which I really like. I saw a thing online where someone there was a report that they were originally going to have it be Obi-Wan and Luke, and then they changed it to Leia. And I'm so glad they didn't do Luke, because it wouldn't have worked in, it wouldn't have worked at all. And I think Leia knowing Obi-Wan before and doesn't really change that much. Maybe a bit of the dialogue from Help Me Obi-Wan Kenobi would change, but I think it was the best choice, is the best choice for an inciting incident for an Obi-Wan show, to have him have to protect one of the Skywalker kids. And it could have only really been Leia, because Luke has had to have had nothing interesting happen to him his entire life. That's like the point of his hero's journey in the original.
Mm-hmm.
Vaughn, I assume you haven't seen episode 4 since Kenobi's come out.
I have not, but it's rude of you to assume that. No, I haven't rewatched it, but I have.
Have you watched Attack of the Clones since?
Yes. Yes, actually. and Revenge. But I haven't seen the original one yet. But no, I've seen a couple clips, actually, because I wanted to see like the precise dialogue, because people were online were like, it ruins the original. And I was like, I'm pretty sure it doesn't. And yeah, no, I don't, like you say, I don't think it would negatively impact anything in episode 4. It just makes it better, in my view, that they did know each other before, that he has already saved her life once. I also think that there's like a massive pass on that dialogue that she has leaving the recording for Obi-Wan, because like she's doing that in a diplomatic capacity. It's not like a personal plea for him. And it would also kind of like betray, this is definitely retconning, but it would betray that they actually have a personal relationship if that recording did fall into somebody else's hands. So I think that it's like, it just makes it even better, in my view.
So the other question I had, which may be a little bit more hard to answer, is just generally speaking, the Star Wars TV shows and Kenobi in particular, how do you think about those sort of in the canon, and in regards to, you know, if you were wanting to rewatch the films in a set order, would you consider adding a TV show in there as well? You know, would you want to be able to go episode 3 Kenobi, episode 4, and or do you consider them almost slightly disconnected, in the sense of if you were doing a rewatch, you wouldn't include the TV shows? I don't know if you've had any thoughts on that yet.
I mean, personally, I would slot them in, but also like you can watch media however you want. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to be like policing how other people watch Star Wars, but
I was meaning more personal preference for how you envision the sort of Star Wars, because it's not just that we add more things to it like we do with something like the MCU. Maybe it's changing a little bit now, but the MCU was kind of sort of in a set order, and it's doing maybe a little bit more adding stuff to it, such as like the Black Widow film that sort of came before or whatever. But you know, Star Wars is just so like we move forward this year and then we jump back that year and then we sort of side story going on, so it's really unique in that regard as far as visual media is concerned.
Yeah, and we had talked about this, I think, on the Kenobi episode that we did last, that the Star Wars universe has that added advantage of not being a linear timeline within their cinematic universe, so they can jump around to different eras and tell different stories. And that's a really big plus for them, because they can expand the timeline as much as they want. They don't have to just go forward. So that is a really great kind of bonus for them. Like I said, I slot them in. I watch 1, 2 Clone Wars, 3, now I guess Kenobi, Rogue One. Like I do it that way if I want to, but sometimes I also just watch Revenge for like 8 times in a row. You know what I mean? So you can do whatever you want. Steele, what do you do?
So, I mean, I just kind of watch whatever I feel like whenever. I think the thing I've been doing most is recently is just jumping into random episodes of Clone Wars, because it's just so easy to do, and they're all just 20 minutes, and you just pop one on. If you want to get real fucked up and just watch Umbara and just get real sad.
Yeah, if you just want to cry.
And just get real sad.
Last week, true story, I was really emotionally sad on a new medication that I'm on. And I was like, I should watch the last four episodes of Clone Wars, season 7. And then I was like, you dumb bitch, why would you do that? So I didn't, but I very nearly did.
Didn't we rewatch that not that long ago?
Yes, we did.
And we got real fucking sad about it. We got real fucking sad about it. And then we watched the 2003 Clone Wars as a bit of a sadness palate cleanser to watch things smash into each other. Mm. So to actually answer the question and not just add more time to this, I always go, if I'm showing someone Star Wars, I'll always go 4, 5, 6 because...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like if someone's watching Star Wars, I always go 4, 5, 6 first because chronological order is something you do after you've already experienced it, because you really should experience it how it was made. It's like watching a prequel before watching an original. If the original was from a different time in cinema, you should always watch the original first. It's like if I'd gone in and watched Blade Runner 2049 before watching the original Blade Runner. Like, you can watch it and it works completely well by itself, but you shouldn't really do that just because the original is so important. I just watch them in whatever I fancy at the time, I suppose. But actual like chronological order is a bit of a headcanon thing for me, because there's so much stuff that I like from the legends, the stuff that Disney made not canon, because it wouldn't fit in, which is absolutely fair. I mean, there's a ridiculous amount of shit in there. So start again, by all means. It doesn't make those stories any less good, but there's a few things like Gendry Tartakovsky's Clone Wars isn't technically canon anymore, but I love it. And there's bits from that, which I consider canon, like the first time Anakin fights Ventress, which hasn't been redone yet, so that's their first fight in my eyes, and I just cherry pick a few things out of the end of the cartoon Clone Wars and just say that bit happened.
Yeah, I'm very disappointed in you all that you didn't give the correct answer, which is you start in episode 2, the best episode. Right, okay.
You watch episode 2, then episode 4, then episode 2, then episode 5.
There's a Kenobi-centric version where you watch the original first and then you watch the prequels to get Kenobi's like backstory after he's died, and then you go and watch the rest of the original trilogy after that, which is a weird one, but I haven't done it, but it certainly exists. There you go. There's your fun fact for the day.
There you go. Fun fact for the day. Right. Shall we move on to the quiz?
Yeah. Real quick. We've gotten far away from it, but yay or nay, bodily autonomy theory. What do you think? Steel.
Well, I think it's pretty much intended in especially with the clones.
Yeah.
Like there's the question of what do we do after the war's over? You know, we're fighting for this to happen, but what happens to us after that? And they bring that back in the last season of Clone Wars, which I really like, where Rex says about having mixed feelings about the war because they wouldn't exist without it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other examples of that in all the trilogies, even if the last one kind of dropped it.
Yay or nay?
Oh, sorry. Yay.
Simon.
I always like Steele's one word answers because I know I can just, you know, I can expect a beautiful paragraph and then the one word. Yes.
I was giving you the man to think, Simon.
Thank you. I often need that.
I know you'd have to go on Google and Google what is a Star War before.
I'm like,
Star War.
When does Spock turn up? yes. Yes, I'm with Steele on that. Yes.
Wicked.
Okay, wicked smart. All right. Okay.
You think I'm wicked smart? You think I'm wicked smart, Simon?
Always. Oh, there's a side thing. Could Boston people exist within the Star Wars universe?
Yes, motherfucker. Bill Burr is in it.
No, I mean, as like actual, like, you know.
Like, does Boston exist in Star Wars?
Yeah, I want like an actual like Boston, like planet of Bostonians.
Oh, God, I want that. That so bad.
What's the fighting? What's the fighting the Empire version of the Boston Tea Party? I guess it's stealing the plans. Is it stealing the plans?
No, because the Boston Tea Party was kind of petty.
Maybe like it's going to be an Andor.
They dumped like the equivalent of like $3 million worth of tea in the harbor, I think it was. So it wouldn't be as big as blowing up the Death Star.
What about
maybe in episode one? When Anakin blows up the space.
That's a good one.
Station.
Maybe you could say that Han Solo's just day-to-day existence is that. Right, okay, let's get on with the question.
There's also in The Mandalorian where Bill Burr blows up that manufacturing plant that they were using.
That one.
And he's from Boston.
There you go. That's the Boston Tea Party.
He made his own tea party and he is the Boston in that tea party.
Yes, he is. Yeah, he is. We love Bill Burr for that.
We do. Okay, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have that made you guys too excited. I'm sorry.
Oh, wait, one more thing, Sam. No, I'm joking. I'm joking this time.
Go ahead, you red coat jackass.
Anyway.
Simon is so tired, guys.
He's so tired.
The other thing I was going to say about Kenobi. I just remembered.
Kobe.
About Kobe was, there's always the worry about fatigue with Star Wars and fatigue with superheroes and all of those things. But the thing that really tires me out is fucking fan reactions to things and how scummy they can be. And I remember I was just trying to think my answer to the Kenobi question. And I was just like, am I going to talk about the fucking fan reactions to everything? I'm so sick of it.
Okay, well, we'll add that to your thoughts, and you'll know that I have some more in 10 minutes' time when you interrupt me again. I'd like to thank Daniel, who's definitely my favorite contributor to this show, and he has come up with another Star Wars quiz for us. So thank you, Daniel. I really appreciate it.
Daniel is all of our favorite contributor to this show. He's fantastic. We love Daniel.
We do. So before we took a summer break, Daniel had sent me this quiz, and we were actually going to do this one to celebrate Pride Month. So this quiz celebrates the amazing LGBTQIA+ characters who populate the galaxy far, far away, helping to both reflect and pave the way for the community here in our galaxy. Isn't that nice? So we have 10 questions that are related to that. So in Queen's Shadow by E.K. Johnson, it is revealed that, again, apologies for my pronunciation of these things, is it Sabe or Saba? One of Padme's handmaids is pansexual, but who first played this character in The Phantom Menace?
Keira Knightley?
Okay.
Wasn't it?
It was, yes.
That's right.
Thanks. For confirming Simon.
Yes. Question two.
I was just assuming that every answer was going to be Lando Calrissian in this.
Yeah.
Who wears the most awesome capes? I mean, again, people are just characters are written here, and I'm assuming they exist, and Daniel isn't setting me up. So I'll try my best here. Dr. Aphra is a fan favorite character who in her own comic series is not only confirmed to be attracted to women, but shares the first actually visible same-sex kiss in canon. What is her most commonly listed profession? So that's the first question, and then there's a second question after that. So what's her most commonly listed profession?
You know, I can't I can't remember. I've only read Dr. Aphra in the Vader comics that she's in, where she helps Vader out with her droids, which are amazing, amazing characters. But I don't know off the top of my head. Go on.
Archaeologist.
A what? What?
Archaeologist.
Archaeologist.
Archaeologist. As in, you know, archaeology.
Oh.
Fun.
There you go. Name one of her lovers.
Yeah, can't do that question. Can't do that one. I'm a fake fan of Dr. Aphra.
We have Dr. Eustacia. Eustacia.
Ooh, we love two doctors together. Good on
Yeah. Magna Tolvan and Sana Staros. So no points there, unfortunately.
I love Star Wars names.
Yes.
I love hearing Simon pronounce Star Wars names.
Yes, it might as well be written in Chinese.
I'm gonna get progressively worse at this quiz because all of the representation in yes, here is kind of in books and comics and in 1 second shots that they can take out of the films when they go to China.
Savage.
Yes, exactly. Which canonically asexual character can you meet at Galaxy's Edge? Clue, she has been made into a Lego figurine.
Oh, I know her. She's the one with the blue in her hair. She was in a Lego set. I cannot remember her name. Oh, that's gonna bug me. Go on.
V. Moradi, is that correct? Is that how we're saying it?
Maybe it's Vi. I don't know.
But, Vi Moradi, V. Moradi. However you pronounce it, that is the correct answer.
But yeah, I know her. She's in the Tales from Galaxy's Edge book, and also a big part of the experience. They did a really cool thing with Galaxy's Edge where they started just shoving the planet from Galaxy's Edge into different media. So before I'd even known Galaxy's Edge was a thing, I'd already read about that planet in the Thrawn book. They just started like popping it in different places. So it would be like, oh, I know what that is.
I'm gonna break the wall for a second. And if you're interested in how Disney does all of that, Simon and I recorded an episode for Impressions of America Today on how Disney manages this marketing kind of strategy, and historically how they did it in the 1950s and developed these ideas for cross-promotional media in their parks and films and TV and all of the intellectual properties that they own. So if you're really interested in what Steele just said, jump over to Impressions of America and give that one a listen.
That also reminds me, we should do an episode about Shadows of the Empire when we're done with all the movies and things, because that was a really interesting thing that Lucasfilm did, where they, to generate hype for the re-release of the original trilogy in 96 and the prequels in 99? Nine. Wow, fake fan. They released a book called Shadows of the Empire, which also had a video game called Shadows of the Empire attached to it, a comic series called Shadows of the Empire, new action figures, and a soundtrack to have while you're reading the different chapters. It was crazy. It was a whole thing. Very interesting. We should definitely do something about that sometime.
We also talk about Star Wars on that episode about Disney parks and how Disney and George Lucas in 1955 and 1977 respectively revolutionized all of these things that Steele is talking about. So genuinely, please listen to that episode if you're interested in what he just said.
And Vaughn is actually doing cross promotion while talking about cross promotion. Beautiful.
Yes, I am indeed. I am a Disney heir. Ugh, gross. All right, maybe, Simon, hit us with the next question.
Maybe okay.
Mirror.
Okay. Apologies for how I pronounce these, as always. Larma Diassi and Robbie Tice. Again, apologies. Share the first live-action same kiss in The Rise of Skywalker. But what film did Diassi first appear in?
She was in The Last Jedi. I think if I'm thinking of which one of those they are, because I cannot remember which one's which. They're not characters that I've Wikipedia'd. She pops up in The Last Jedi. She announces that Leia's been injured and passes the baton over to Holdo.
Mm.
That is correct. The Last Jedi. Well done.
Hey. Oh, just thinking about that kiss makes me really mad because of things they could have done instead of just like a one shot that they can just easily chop out. Oh, it makes me so mad. Especially how they went so hard on no homoing Poe and Finn in The Rise of Skywalker by giving them both new girlfriends.
Oh.
I cannot wait for us to do a Rise of Skywalker episode.
In many ways, every episode we do steal is a Rise of Skywalker episode.
Yeah.
Well, they set my hopes up with The Last Jedi that they might actually have something to say, and then they didn't.
And then they did. Right, okay, question 5. Rae Sloane is an Imperial officer and a bisexual woman who features in several Star Wars stories, such as Squadrons video game. What is the highest rank she achieves in the Imperial Navy?
Oh, is it Vice Admiral?
I have here Grand Admiral.
Oh, she did become a Grand Admiral. Ah.
Good for her.
Good for her. Good for her.
I know none of these, Daniel.
Yeah, these are all pretty deep. It's because, like I said, the representation is
so marginal. Yeah. That's a really good point.
It's Vaughn doesn't want to dive too deep because she doesn't want to come across any gay characters. That's how it works.
Oh, Simon. Obi-Wan is bisexual now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. As of a comic this summer.
Oh, that's cool.
Off a lot of people. So, I mean, that's not in any of the mainstream media, but it is in a comic. And he's a character, so.
It pissed me off. Not because it happened, just because it happened in a book years after the character was created, and it was obvious. It just feels so surface level trying to please people, and I just want good characters that are LGBT. Just make a character and have them in the forefront, have them on the poster that they can't take out when they try and market it to countries that don't like it.
Question 6. Orca and his partner Flix are the first same-sex couple to be confirmed on screen in Star Wars canon. What show did they appear in?
Oh, okay. I don't know these characters, so I'm guessing Resistance.
Correct. Well done.
Hey.
I also think that that's a slight to C-3PO and R2-D2.
They are definitely a couple.
Let's just state that. But
I agree. Well said, Vaughn. Question 7. In the Star Wars Squadrons video game, one of your wingmates when you play as the New Republic is Kiel Venzi, who is non-binary. What ship do they predominantly fly?
I actually don't know. I've not played Squadrons yet.
A-Wing.
Oh.
So there you go. Daniel is really putting you guys to the test today.
Yeah.
And sticking with Squadrons, so you know, he's talking Squadrons. Sticking with Squadrons, when you play as the Empire, you meet Verko Gray, who mentions his husband in the game. What is Gray's call sign?
No idea.
Titan Leader.
Ooh.
Yeah.
What was it?
Titan Leader.
Titan. I thought you said Titan. Eaten.
I thought you said Eaten.
That sounds right.
Eaton leader, Titan leader. It's he's a leader of some kind. Right, next one. In the short story Off MSE 6 and Men, it is heavily implied that Tarkin has a relationship with a male stormtrooper.
Ooh.
What anthology collection was this story published in?
Was it From a Certain Point of View?
It was Star Wars From a Certain Point of View, 2017. Hmm. Well done, Steele.
Something about me doesn't like the idea of the Empire being cool with it. It's just one of those things where I just assume the Empire is going to be homophobic.
Like a don't ask, don't tell policy?
Yeah.
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 No, I could see that.
I also can't imagine Tarkin being, like, he just doesn't seem, maybe it's one of those characters where I just think that they're so evil that they just have no interest in it.
Hmm.
Maybe not. It's one of those things where I think Because they have the whole thing with the Empire not liking non-human races,
right?
Which I really like.
Nazis don't deserve orgasms, is what you're saying.
You know what? That is a great. Actually, we should make that our.
That's like a political philosophy of mine. Nazis don't deserve orgasms. So, I say that a lot.
I love that.
Let's put that on a t-shirt.
There you go.
Right. Once again, we are diving back into video games, which I think probably tells us a story around the representation of of characters. The first LGBTQIA plus character we ever saw in Star Wars was Juhani back in a video game in 2003. What was the video game?
Oh, I did not know this. Is it Jedi Academy?
I have Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic.
Oh, it's from KOTOR. Oh, okay. Oh, I never finished KOTOR. I didn't play it when it came out, and every time I tried to play it, I just never had the patience for it. But I played like half of it on my phone.
Right, okay. Point.
That shows how far we've come as a society.
Yes. The video games of 2003 now comfortably fit on your smart device. Right. That's us. So like I say, that was probably a little more difficult only because Star Wars isn't exactly making it easy with canonically gay or ace or non-straight characters. So but I think it was still very much worth a dive into this to show that.
Absolutely.
Not a single answer was Lando. I was thinking at least one of them would be Lando. The plot twist, every person on that list has also at some point met Lando Calrissian.
Slept with.
Yeah. Apart from the asexual one,
of course.
Good
for her.
Who just had a nice chat.
And the lesbian.
Oh yeah, of course.
Everyone who wanted to.
Yeah.
We're getting into weird territory.
Yeah, it's getting weird.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Lando flirted with them, and they were like, "Nah." And then he went back to his ship and fucked his robot.
My third wife.
my recommendation. Our recommendation for today is go and watch the Calrissian Chronicles on YouTube, where a guy does a wonderful dramatic reading of an AI created Lando Calrissian Chronicles, where he talks about his many wives, and it's fucking brilliant.
It's wonderful. It's really exceptional stuff.
So yeah, take a note of that, and then you too can laugh hysterically like my co-hosts. shall we call that a close there then, guys?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Well, Vaughn, thank you for presenting today's theory, as always. It certainly brought out some conversation and was very well worthwhile diving into, so thank you for that. And still, although I joke, I do always appreciate your contributions. It's always both interesting and full of life, so thank you as always.
Thank you, Simon. We should come back to this one and talk about droids at some point, because I feel like that's a really important one as well.
Absolutely. Right. From myself, Simon, from Vaughn, from Steel, from Obi-Wan Kenobi, and from Kobe, thank you very much for listening. And we'll have another episode for you in the near future. Goodbye.
Bye.
See you later, guys. Thank you.